This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We are here ready and eager to discuss the important events of this past week. We have our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And this week, also in Britain, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Is World War III about to break out? I mean, there are a lot of people asking this question with the Trump administration launching missiles in Syria, dropping bombs in Afghanistan, an unpredictable nuclear North Korea making provocative moves, Russia and Iran issuing threats against the United States. There are a lot of people wondering where this is all leading. Trumpet writer Brad McDonald gave a program about this yesterday on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. On today's program, we're going to get into a few of the stories that are contributing to this concern about a potential World War III. We're going to start by talking about the mother of all bombs, this massive bomb that the United States dropped in Afghanistan yesterday targeting the Islamic State. And to learn about this, we're going to turn to our Middle East analyst, Brent.
Yeah, so this bomb, the massive ordnance air blast munition, it's about 30 feet long, weighs more than 11 tons. It creates the largest explosion. It's one of the most, apart from a nuclear weapon, one of the most powerful non-nuclear bombs that we have. And it's never been used before. It was developed back in 2003 for potentially the Iraq war, but hasn't been used. That was until Thursday when it was dropped out of the sky on an eastern Afghanistan province, an area that was that the Islamic State is currently using for part of its bases there. There's about 800 Islamic soldiers there in Afghanistan. And Mr. Trump and the military under him decided that it was time to bring out the mother of all bombs, or as it's otherwise known as MOAB.
All right. Tell us why this target.
Well, to use this bomb, you basically have to have an area that you are sure there's no civilians in, or you're going to get civilian casualties, just because it has about a blast radius of about, or destruction radius of about half a mile. So this is huge. And that's why one of the reasons we haven't seen it used elsewhere. And this is one of those mountainous regions where Osama bin Laden hid as he stole away into Pakistan back in 2001. It's up on a mountain that's 13,000 feet tall. What about 1,000 people can live and survive in this tunnel complex on this mountain that this bomb was trying to target? They have their own hydroelectric power system. They have their own munitions facility in this mountain. So he was going after this symbolic target, really, when you talk about the Taliban and Osama bin Laden there, but also an important one that can wipe out a lot of jihadis.
And what sort of effect has this had? It seems like for the Trump administration to do this just a week after having dropped all of those missiles on Syria, that this does demonstrate some spine and some resolve in the U.S. administration that we haven't seen coming out of the U.S. for quite some time. The reaction to this, it seemed like after last week in Syria that it was pretty positive among quite a lot of nations. Obviously, a couple of nations accepted. What about this week?
Yeah, I think at least from what's coming out, other nations that have commented on it, and as far as the American population, I think they're happy with this use of force. You have to look at both of these acts having a cumulative effect, because they were without warning necessarily, and by necessity, really. If you're going to attack these two sites, you don't want these people that you're attacking to escape. And yet it has created this sense around the world, and especially in America, that we have finally a president that's going to act differently than Obama, that is going to stand up to the bad guys, basically, and not let America be walked all over. And again, these two targets, no one really disagrees with the targeting of the Islamic State and Bashar al-Assad after what he did 2 weeks ago. And it is helping people see that we have a different president in the Oval Office.
So put this in context for us, Brent. Obviously, we were talking about this before we started and just what is happening here. It doesn't take a whole lot to distinguish the Trump administration from the previous administration and to show a show of force by America in contrast to what we've seen for at least 8 years from the United States. But in the big picture, what we saw in Syria isn't necessarily going to change the long-term prognosis there. We talked about that last week. I mean, it's a little bit hard to say how deep America's resolve goes to make a lasting change there. It was certainly a show of force. Here in Afghanistan, this is a situation that obviously isn't going to be resolved by dropping one bomb. How much of a difference is this going to make in the long run?
Long-term, absolutely nothing as far as to the actual fight against Islamic State or Bashar al-Assad, unless it changes the way that they think. And that's part of it. I mean, the targets of this bomb weren't just ISIS. They were Russia. They were North Korea. They were China, because Trump is trying to send a message that he is willing to act on the world scene, and he's willing to act against interests of those countries. He might not have a direct attack against China or Russia, those places, but he is willing to stand up for what he thinks is American interests in the face of what those other countries want. And I think across the board, there will be other nations that are changing their thinking towards the United States and how they act towards it based on these highly symbolic targets.
Any idea, Richard, on what the response has been in Europe to what we've seen from the Trump administration these past 2 weeks?
Hope, probably. And if you look, America, the biggest thing that Europe worried about was this America First policy, this isolationist policy, this idea that America is no longer going to be the world's policeman. I think Donald Trump even said something along those lines, that America is no longer going to be there to generally enforce law and order in the world, but rather just enforce narrow and immediate short-term American interests. Now, with him getting involved to prevent chemical weapons in Syria, where there's not necessarily a direct American interest, and then also with his comments that NATO is no longer obsolete, I think there's kind of a hope in Europe that we're moving beyond the initial rhetoric of the Donald Trump presidency and that we're settling into something that's more normal. Now, though, I think at this stage, it's still only hope. I think Europe hasn't. I mean, Donald Trump has changed his mind quite quickly on this, and I think people are still reserving judgment to see where this goes. And I think that's the state for a lot of people, because I mean, yes, these were very symbolic events, but fundamentally, they were still low-cost operations for the United States. They didn't really risk any American lives or require huge politically or a huge amount of political capital behind them. So I think they've done some symbolism, but they wouldn't have fundamentally challenged the belief that Vladimir Putin probably has, that America is not interested in anything that high risk, anything that puts a large number of American lives at risk, boots on the ground, this kind of thing. So I think it's just a sense of, well, this looks like things are moving in the direction we want them to go in. Let's just wait and see if they stay that way.
Well, you said that that this was a change from what Donald Trump had talked about, this America First policy, more isolationist and relinquishing that role of policeman. And yet he did talk about bombing ISIS and destroying ISIS. And
he did. But he also said specifically that we wouldn't go after Assad. And I think that's
right.
I think it's the Syria attack that's gained a lot more attention, focus in the news, in just discussion among politicians in Syria. I mean, I guess it's early days after the use of the Moab bomb. But that I don't think has gained as much attention, because that was more in line with what people expected from Donald Trump. Whereas I think the Syria attack was much more unexpected, and it kind of caused a lot more people to sit up and kind of think, well, that, you know, what's going on here?
Right. Well, it is. What strikes me is just how much people seem to almost have a sense of relief in America standing up and making these moves, say small as they may be in the long term. There's still a sense that, well, here's a man who is willing to stand up and use force against wrongdoing and to put some of these evildoers to flight. That just hasn't been the case. And you know, it really does seem like, well, he's done this. It was Syria last week. It's Afghanistan this week. What's he going to do next week? There's this sense of kind of just not quite knowing where this is leading that at this point kind of works in America's favor. And it seems like it's garnered him a certain amount of goodwill.
Yeah, I think it has. I think the one spot on that maybe is just the unpredictability. So Europe, you know, we've talked about how the rise of Donald Trump and his retreat from NATO has kind of spurred Europe to look at doing more with their military. And now that America's kind of doing more, I think Europe's still not going to step back from wanting to do more in their military, because I think there's the fear. There is that sense of, OK, what America is America going to do next week? We liked it this week. Will we like it next week?
Right.
And I think there's kind of a big and North Korea is kind of the big, you know, he just bombed ISIS at the drop of a hat. He bombed Syria at the drop of the. I mean, I'm kind of putting it from the point of view of liberals in Europe. Is he about to start nuclear war with North Korea? And remember that their worldview, I think they still kind of view Donald Trump as an idiot. That's the way a lot of, especially the left in Europe, look at it. And so in some ways, it's kind of fed into some of their prejudices in terms of the unpredictability there.
Well, that definitely gives us a good transition into our next story. We're going to go now to what's happening with North Korea. The Chinese president visited President Trump last week. North Korea was definitely on the agenda in their discussion. North Korea's been testing some dangerous weapons lately that have a lot of people on edge. There's talk that they're on the cusp of testing another nuclear weapon. The Trump administration wants to put a stop to it. Well, is it possible that what we're talking about here with Syria and Afghanistan, that this is actually maybe bringing China on side to where they may actually help Donald Trump out? For this, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, it seems like we're really having to do a Korean Peninsula update just about every week lately, because there's just so much volatility there, so many involved parties, and the tensions are steadily escalating. This week on Wednesday, news broke that North Korea is in the final phase of preparing yet another nuclear bomb test, this one possibly 10 to 20 times larger than any previous tests. Voice of America broke this story, and they pointed to some new satellite imagery just showing that the North Koreans have placed a nuclear device in a tunnel at their nuclear testing site. And officials say that a test appears imminent, and many speculate that it could be carried out tomorrow, Saturday, April 15th. Tomorrow marks the 105th birthday of North Korea's founder, Kim Il-sung, and that day, April 15th, is the country's most important annual holiday. They've conducted some of their largest tests on that date before, so it would make sense for the next one to be carried out tomorrow. And then the reports of this imminent and illegal nuclear test come just days after, as you mentioned, Chinese President Xi Jinping spending a couple of days with the U.S. president in Florida. And following on their meeting, the United States ordered a carrier strike group to start moving toward the Korean Peninsula. This group includes warships. It includes a nuclear-powered Nimitz-class aircraft carrier the size of more than three football fields. Earlier, you mentioned Trump showing spine and resolve, and I think deploying this carrier strike group is a little bit more of that. It's a major show of force against North Korea. And then Japan also took on a significantly higher profile this week, just saying that it's ready to team up with the U.S. militarily to contain the North Korean threat. And then, as you mentioned, the big surprise was China. China apparently has boosted its military presence along the North Korean border. Some reports say that China has abruptly increased its number there from 50,000 to 150,000 troops, which would be quite a significant increase if that's true. It's still not confirmed. But around the same time as the reports of that troop buildup emerged, an editorial was published in China's Global Times. That's usually just kind of a mouthpiece for the ruling Communist Party in China. And this editorial said that if North Korea's nuclear activities jeopardize northeastern China, then China will bomb North Korea. That was a threat that we've not heard before mm-hmm. from the Chinese. And it's, you know, it's not totally official, but it's still quite significant. And then on the same day that happened, China ordered several North Korean cargo ships that had been parked at Chinese ports to turn around and go back home. These ships were loaded up with coal that North Korea was hoping to sell to China. But China said, no, we don't want your coal, so take it back to North Korea. Back in February, China banned all imports of North Korean coal, which is North Korea's most important export product. And it looks like a lot of these ships had just been waiting at these ports, just hoping that that ban would be lifted so they could go ahead and unload their coal. But China ordered them to turn around and go back home. And then, in a pretty big surprise, China began to make up for the shortfall of coal from North Korea by significantly increasing its coal imports from the United States. Hmm. So that's being viewed as a big victory for Mr. Trump. He previously declared that one of his big goals is reviving America's coal sector. And so now, in kind of a double win, he is convincing China not to buy North Korean coal and to buy American coal. So it's I think it is quite probable that Mr. Trump made the deal to sell China U.S. coal in lieu of North Korean coal, probably during the Florida visit when Mr. Xi was visiting there. So there is kind of a big question about how Mr. Trump would have done that. Like, did he undercut the price of North Korean coal? To do that, he would have had to significantly subsidize the American coal. Or he could have also made some sort of trade concessions with China, or even geopolitical concessions to Xi Jinping. Maybe he agreed to let China continue its authoritarian creep into Hong Kong. Maybe he agreed to let China assert some new level of control over Taiwan or the South China Sea. We don't know, but we can be sure that China probably got something pretty substantial out of that deal.
Right. Yeah, they wouldn't agree to that kind of a concession without receiving some kind of quid pro quo.
Yep. Well, you do just have to wonder how much of China's foreign policy change is in response to America's foreign policy change. I know in the lead up to the Mar-a-Lago meeting between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, President Trump had tweeted twice, once saying that any North Korean solution needs to involve China, and another time saying, but if China doesn't do anything, the U.S. will go unilateral.
Right.
Shortly after that, he bombed Syria. Shortly after that, he ordered a carrier strike group to head towards the Koreas. And shortly after that, he dropped the world's largest non-nuclear bomb on Afghanistan. And so you almost wonder, some of these is China's just like, just cool down there. The last thing we want is a Moab bomb on North Korea. So we'll use our economic leverage to handle this. Just don't go crazy here.
Yeah, this is definitely keeping you on the edge of your seat, isn't it? I mean, none of these things that we're talking about were necessarily things that anyone would have been able to predict specifically. I mean, we've seen the trajectory of the United States going down for so long. For these moves to look like, you know, something of an abrupt turn, I would imagine that there are a lot of nations. We're talking about China, we're talking about Iran and Russia and several European nations that are trying to adjust their calculus based on what they think that the United States is going to do next. And, you know, the longer term trends that we've been following, where they really are trying to undermine the United States in a lot of ways, there's not necessarily anything changing in that larger picture, but how it plays out day to day, week to week, it seems like there's just a whole lot of volatility right now.
Yeah, that's right. It really seems like, especially the Korean Peninsula there, many pundits and analysts have said that that's going to be the major challenge for the Trump administration. What's going to happen there? And it'll be very vital for us to keep a close eye on that spot.
Well, thanks, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program, 101.3 KPCG. We're going to finish our first segment with two attacks that took place this week, one in America on Monday, the other in Germany on Tuesday. We'll start with Germany. Yet another terrorist attack in this European country as three bombs exploded near the bus of a professional soccer team. For this, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
That's right. It seems like somebody tried to take out the Dortmund football team. They blew it up while they were on their way to, I think it was a Champions League match. Was it a quarterfinal maybe? So they tried to tried to mess with Europe's favorite pastime, as we put it on our website. And I think what is especially interesting is they left a note, or it looks they left a note that's probably from the attackers at the scene, where they said, we're going to start doing this thing more often. We're going to start going after high profile figures. And they blamed Angela Merkel. They blamed Germany's reconnaissance flights over Syria. So we could be seeing the start of a new tactic now, as an Islamic State kind of grassroots lone wolf style jihad, where, you know, killing a lot of people can be hard. So they can maybe they try and so maybe they're looking now to motivate these kind of radicalized individuals to just target a few high profile people, like attacking a football team, where, you know, this story got a lot of mileage. They didn't even succeed in killing anybody, or and then I think they just wounded one person and it was non-life threatening. But it shows that they can make it an attack that has a lot of impact on a lot of people by going after these kind of profile individuals.
With as many of these kinds of attacks as we're seeing, and these lone wolf attacks and one-off and one guy in a bus plowing through people, or a few bombs here and there, it does seem like there's this becoming this kind of steady drumbeat of these kinds of attacks. And to this point, we still haven't seen the really robust kind of response that we would expect to be able to actually deal with this in any kind of a real lasting way. It almost seems like to this point that Germany has kind of absorbed the blows and gone on with its business.
That's right. I mean, it still is playing a big effect on the German election that we're seeing. Angela Merkel is it seems like, even almost by the week, tightening her stance on immigration. But it does seem like it's immigration that has become the political issue rather than terrorist attacks. They're closely tied, though, and I think that's where you can kind of see the result of these attacks most, is this hardening of attitude to immigration and this fear that Muslim immigrants coming into Europe are going to launch more attacks like this. Then I think Sweden we talked briefly about on this show about that attack in Stockholm on Friday. And again, you do see some political changes. You see the rise of the Social Democrats in Sweden that has come from nowhere to be, I think it's about the most popular political party in Sweden. So there are still some responses, but it hasn't fed through to mainstream politicians so far. And so you're seeing the rise of these fringe groups. You're seeing people shifting towards these groups that say that they're going to stand up to Islam and to these radical Islam. But it's not affected really the actions of governments to this point.
All right. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. We'll move on now to the mass shooting in America, this in San Bernardino, California, on Monday. And for this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, so this is the second, I guess, famous mass shooting attack in San Bernardino. The first one had occurred 2 years back and was an Islamic terrorist attack. This one occurred on Monday morning and was a very different type of violence. This was linked to domestic violence. A 53-year-old man walked into a special needs class at a school in San Bernardino, California, and shot his estranged wife 10 times with a revolver, hitting two of the children hiding behind her as well, before killing himself, meaning there's three deaths: himself, his wife, and one of the children who was behind her, and then one injury, the second child behind her. And so police are still looking into all the details, but look like the man who did this had a long history with domestic violence, having separated from a previous wife that he used to be married to in Florida over violent threats he'd made against her, breaking up with a girlfriend a couple years ago after threatening to strangle her with a pillow or come at her with a butcher's knife. And then his current wife, who he's actually only been married to 3 months, they separated after 2 months, and then he was trying to get back together with her before he just snapped and went on a shooting rampage in this classroom.
Well, you have an article about this on thetrumpet.com, mass shooting in San Bernardino, putting this in perspective. Obviously these types of things happen from time to time, but you show statistics that this really isn't all that unusual. This is becoming more and more common in the United States.
Right. This shooting made news primarily because of the fact that there were two special needs children who got caught in the crossfire and were killed, making this a mass shooting. But as far as someone being killed by a current or former romantic partner, they actually say about 3% of all men murdered in the United States, and up about like 34% of all women murdered in the United States aren't murdered by strangers. They're murdered by someone that they either are currently or formerly romantically involved with. So say women especially, there's been over 18,000 killed in the last 15 years in incidents of domestic violence. And they say about roughly half of those are killed with a gun, the other half by some other type of weapon. And sociologists and psychologists who study these things have found that actually it looks like up to roughly 12% of the United States population, 40 million people, have grown up in a home where their domestic violence is just a fact of life, maybe not being killed, but either abused or beaten or hurt. And it is shown that children who grow up in that environment are about 75 times more likely than other children to perpetuate the cycle by committing something like this themselves when they're grown. So as with the majority of America's social problems, it gets back down to when you have a breakdown in your family life at home that leads to an epidemic of crimes in other ways. I mean, gang violence is one manifestation of that. We've hit a lot on this program, but even just perpetuating, just abusing your wife or children or husband within the home is another manifestation that's growing shockingly common in America today.
Mm-hmm. Richard, you had a comment?
Yeah, a question for Andrew just on about the reliability of the stats is, I know over here you get a lot of the statistics on domestic violence include any spanking of a child as an incident of domestic violence. Do you know if that's included in these statistics, or do they exclude that kind of thing?
It could be some of that included. Now, I know England's a little different. In America, spanking's a lot more common than 12% of the population. So I think most cases of like when you're spanking like in like a Christian sense, to where you're under control and not abusing the child, those don't tend to get reported here in America. So normally, if any of those statistics would be included, you would have had to have been hurt or bruised enough to actually get Child Protective Services to take it seriously.
Not to mention the fact that some of the other statistics you bring out in this article, the fact that this was the 121st mass shooting of this year, we're only in the middle of April, 3.5 months into the year, and this is according to Mass Shooting Tracker, that defines a mass shooting as an incident of gun violence in which four or more people are shot. And then the fact that three women are murdered every day in the United States by a current or former romantic partner. These are and the one that you mentioned, 34% of women who are murdered in the United States, it's taking place at the hand of this. We're talking about murders. We're not talking about less extreme forms of abuse, which would be far more common and pervasive.
Right. The only statistic that would include the less extreme is that 40 million people who grow up with domestic violence. But all the other statistics highlighted in the article are only related to those who've actually been killed in domestic violence.
That's a disturbing story. We appreciate you bringing that report to us. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. And coming up, we're going to talk about a major development in French politics that threatens the future of the European Union, the return of former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, yet another Asian ally turning away from the United States and toward China, and America's newest Supreme Court justice. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We're going to start this second segment with a very important story. The future of the European Union really has some dark clouds forming over it. Of course, there are issues like the economic problems, immigration, terrorist attacks. But we've been following the political issues besieging several European states, not just Britain leaving the Union, but the rise of a lot of political parties that are against the ideals of the European unification project. Recent developments show that France is increasingly moving in this direction. For the latest of these, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, it really has been a roller coaster presidential election. We've been talking a bit about Marine Le Pen on this program a lot. François Fillon was doing really well, and Emmanuel Macron is the current favorite. But there's been a new politician that's really kind of the one that everyone's talking about right now. And this is Jean-Luc Mélenchon. He has kind of come from almost nowhere. He's been around 10% of the vote, but he had a very strong performance on some of the televised debates, and he's now catapulted into third place. He is on polls tend to put him around 18.5% of the vote. And this particular individual is so radically left that I saw one article that says he makes Bernie Sanders look like a centralist. He believes there should be an earnings cap at 400,000 euros, for example. So the government would just take anything you earn above that, a 32-hour work week. Basically, he's a big admirer of Hugo Chavez and this kind of thing. So a real radical leftist individual. But the main thing that is interesting about him is that he is very anti-euro, the European Union. He wrote a book a couple of years ago in which he wrote that the German Empire is back. This book is basically saying that Germany is invading France through the euro. He said in writing this book, he said, "My goal is to pierce the armor of bliss of so many commentators fascinated by Germany. She has become a danger to her neighbors and partners. I denounce her arrogance and so-called model imposed for her profit alone. A monster is born across the Rhine." So he is not a big fan of the euro, to put it mildly. And what he wants to do is he wants to go to Germany and say, have the European Central Bank print us 100 billion euros and give it to us to spend, or we're going to quit the euro and we're going to destroy your currency union.
Wow.
And he wants to basically, that's his policy, drop that ultimatum on Germany. He wants to kind of get Greece on board and maybe Italy as well, and form this coalition to stand up to Germany. So what's fascinating there is you look at that, you know, that's his policy. Marine Le Pen also wants France out of the euro. She wants France printing its own money, etc. Maybe not quite so radically confrontational with Germany, but this, basically the same policy. And between the two of them, these have the support of about 42-45% of French voters right now. And so you're starting to get close to a majority in France, you know, the second nation of Europe in so many ways. It's mm-hmm. built around, you know, France and Germany wanting out of the euro. You'd look over at Italy and you've got the same situation there where you're getting close to a majority now wanting out of the euro. So there's kind of the obvious point that, well, you could end up with either Marine Le Pen or Mélenchon winning the election, becoming president, which would immediately trigger absolute meltdown in Europe. So that's a very real possibility. One third of likely voters said they haven't decided who they're going to vote for. So there's kind of anything to play for in the election. So either of them could win. And even if they don't, you've still got 40% of Frenchmen who were prepared to vote for these two that don't like their country being in the euro. You know, what does that say about the future of the eurozone when 40-50% of French Italians want out?
Just so I understand, these the policies, the economic policies that you're saying that this man supports, how much is his persona centered around, you know, well, you'll have to work less, 32-hour work week, and we're going to take it from the rich people and give it to the poor people, that type of thing, versus this Germany is a bully and we need to stand up to them and prevent them from taking advantage of the other nations within the European Union?
They're both. They're connected. because socialist governments in Europe want to borrow tons of money and to do the kind of socialist things that he wants to do. And the only real way to do those kind of things is to borrow a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And Germany is the one that's stopping them from doing that.
Yeah.
You know, there are rules in place that Germany is behind enforcing that limit the amount that states can borrow. And so Germany is becoming more and more viewed as kind of the enemy of socialism. And so if you are a socialist, especially a far left socialist, well, part of being that means that you're an enemy of Germany. And so you're starting to see this kind of Germany coming under attack and the euro coming under attack from the far right or just the not quite so far right. But then you're also seeing that come under attack from the far left as well. And so it's kind of, it's a function of his socialism. And the other thing I just want to mention about him quickly is he is the most popular politician in France right now. A poll found that 68% said they had a favorable opinion of him. So even if 68%, they're certainly not saying they're going to vote for him. They like him. They see him as a nice guy and someone with his heart in the right place.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about there. We're going to have to cut it off there. But just seeing these crises continue to roll through Europe and as much discontent as there is among the European voters against the way that the project is being run right now, you know that there's going to be some significant changes on the horizon. We'll definitely have to keep abreast of what's happening in Europe. We appreciate that, Richard. Iranian presidential elections are next month, and this week a new candidate threw his name in the ring. He's actually not a new candidate, but an old one, former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And there's some controversy surrounding his entering the field. For this, we're going to go back to Brent.
Yeah, it's very interesting because a month ago, he said that it was probably unlikely that he would go in it. And a year ago, you had the Ayatollah Khamenei. He came out and told him via a letter that he thought it unwise for him to run in the election at all. And yet what happened just this week was he was attending the Interior Ministry in support of one of his former vice presidents, or one of his staffers, basically his vice president, Hamid Barghei. And he was going to run. And then while he was there, he whips out his paperwork and decides to run. And the media has an absolute field day in the chaos that ensues because Ahmadinejad, again, was told by the Ayatollah not to run. Well, Ahmadinejad came out and said that, well, the Ayatollah kind of just advised me not to run. So it wasn't a hard and fast rule. So I'm running, but I'm really still going to support my vice president, my former vice president. I really want him to win.
So how does this factor into the bigger picture here? I mean, we talk about, obviously, just Iranian politics is kind of a strange animal just because you have over the whole thing this theocracy that is dominated by the Ayatollah. This seems like somewhat of an act of defiance. And in some sense, you look at it and say, well, you know, how far is this going to go if it's going contrary to the wishes of the supreme leader?
Right. Well, most people expect him to be vetoed before he makes it onto the ballot. You remember that back, I think, the last elections, 2013, there are over 100 plus people that signed up to go ahead and be part of the presidential vote. And then only, I believe, 6 or 7 of those, not too many, were vetted, because you've got the Guardian Council to go through. That's 12 members. Half of them are selected by the Ayatollah. So he's basically got a monopoly on power. The Ayatollah does, through his people, he's put in those positions to determine who can actually run, who can go on the ballot. So most people expect Ahmadinejad to be vetoed anyway. AP came out and said that, well, maybe he's doing this to ensure that they don't veto his vice president because they're not going to veto both of them. So at least one of them's going to get through. Now, that's a possibility as well. It is interesting, though, because we have talked a lot on the trumpet about Ahmadinejad. He belongs to the sect of Shia Islam, the 12er sect, that believes that chaos and world upheaval, what will lead to the coming of the Messiah. Not all Shiites believe in that, but he definitely does, and followers of his believe that. So he, while most people think he won't even make it to the ballot, well, hey, he actually signed up in defiance of the Ayatollah. So it's just something to watch, definitely something to watch going forward, whether he's going to progress in this presidential election.
Yeah, I guess we'll know in the next few weeks, won't we? May 19th is the election. So, well, we appreciate that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We've just published the newest edition of the Trumpet magazine, the May-June edition. And in it, we have an article by Jeremiah Jacques about how several Asian nations are turning their backs on their alliance with the United States and turning toward China. You can find that article online along with the entire edition. Definitely worth checking out. This week, another Asian country followed that same pattern, and that is Cambodia. For this story, we're going to go to the author of that article, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the Cambodian government abruptly told a United States Navy unit to leave the country. And then the very next day, Cambodia accepted a new $157 million aid package from China. The U.S. unit that's being kicked out is called the U.S. Navy Mobile Construction Battalion. It's better known as its nickname, the Seabees. And it's been operating in Cambodia for about a decade now on a humanitarian mission. The Seabees have expanded many schools and hospitals and all kinds of other projects like that. Seabees has spent millions of dollars helping to build Cambodia up. And I think it's 11 different Cambodian provinces that have benefited from all of those projects. But now, pretty abruptly, the Cambodian government says, we don't want CBs here anymore. So they're kicking the unit out. And this also follows very closely on a decision made in January, on January 16th, actually, when Cambodia decided to cancel some major joint military drills that it holds every year with the United States. So clearly Cambodia is tiring of the United States and just don't want help or support from America anymore. And then if you look to the north of Cambodia on the map, you can see what the reason behind it is, and that is China, as you mentioned there. The very next day after the CB's departure was announced, Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen accepted that $157 million construction grant from China. And it's not the first time. Since 2002, Cambodia has taken out almost $3 billion in loans from China for dozens of different development projects. But this newest one is the largest of those kinds of grants. And it really just shows that Cambodia seems to be quickly replacing the U.S. with China as its benefactor for many of these kinds of projects. And then also we mentioned that Cambodia canceled those joint military exercises with the United States. But they also recently held their very first military exercises with China. So this shift is underway in infrastructure development and in military matters. Cambodia is shifting away from the U.S. and toward China. And as you mentioned, we've been following this trend for quite a while at the Trumpet. It's not happening just in Cambodia, but also with several smaller Asian nations. Right now, similar realignments are underway in the Philippines, in Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Laos, Myanmar, and some other states too. So it's happening on quite a broad scale.
And all of those countries that you just mentioned, you talk about in that article that's in this Trumpet edition. It's called Will America's Asian Allies Pivot to China? Giving support to see how complete that is happening across the board in all of those Asian nations. Good to put that in context. And then put that in context for us with respect to biblical prophecy, seeing these Asian countries all coming together and rallying behind China.
Yeah, it actually really seems to be showing us the fulfillment of several of the prophecies that we're watching. One of them is the coming together of the kings of the East. Another is the decline of American power. And then also the rise of Chinese power, the rise of, you know, the times of the Gentiles, when we see a great shift of power toward some of those Eastern nations. So with each of these small countries sort of abandoning the sinking U.S. ship and going toward China, it shows a lot of those trends happening all at once.
Well, it's interesting just thinking about that, say, in light of what we were talking about in the first part of the program about just how their nations are reacting to some of the more recent moves of the Trump administration, and specifically in the Asian theater with North Korea. So it will be interesting to see how this unfolds. We see this larger trend of defection away from the United States and toward China. See whether there's any moving of the needle on that trend in light of what's happening elsewhere in the region. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The United States Supreme Court has been restored to a full 9 members after a bruising confirmation process on Monday. Neil Gorsuch took his place on the bench. What did we learn from this process, and what can we expect from the Supreme Court now? For some answers, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. I've seen at least one political commentator compare this confirmation process to the 30 years war, a famous war in the Middle Ages between Protestants and Catholics and the Holy Roman Empire, just because it was about 30 years ago, or it will be 30 years this June, mm-hmm. that they had the first really politicized confirmation process over Judge Robert Bork. Mm-hmm. And obviously Bork was famously slurred and demonized and was not able to take his seat on the court because of his position as a constitutional originalist. And they went through a similar process with Clarence Thomas, another originalist who was actually confirmed. And now finally, here 30 years later, they had Judge Neil Gorsuch sworn into office on Monday as a third originalist, together with Antonin Scalia, who was appointed before the Bork nomination. There have actually only been 4 dyed-in-the-wool constitutional originalist appointed to the court in the past 30-some years. Mm-hmm. But the Senate did end up having to do away with its filibuster rule. They were able to overturn that with a simple majority, which means for the next 2 years you can't filibuster a Supreme Court nominee. And it was able, by doing away with that rule, Gorsuch was able to be confirmed with just a simple majority, 54-4, 45 against. But, I mean, it could be some big changes. I think even here just in a couple days on the 19th, there's a court case coming up dealing with religious freedom. And then as it get into the thick of it, there's going to be I think there's at least 5 fairly controversial court cases on the Supreme Court docket in the next several months, 2 on illegal immigration, 1 on gun control, 2 on religious freedom, 1 even being that case in Colorado, what I think we've talked about before, about the Christian man who refused to bake the homosexual wedding cake. I think that's finally gone to the Supreme Court, which Gorsuch will be able to rule on that case. So a lot of controversial cases going up, which will be interesting and somewhat concerning to see how this unfolds. I know the chairman of the Democratic National Convention, Tom Perez, has gone on record saying that since there's ongoing allegations between Trump and Russian hacking in the election, that any man he nominates isn't a real Supreme Court justice.
Wow.
There was another senator whose name actually escapes me right now who's saying that because the Senate has changed the filibuster rule, that Gorsuch isn't a real Supreme Court justice and any 5-4 Supreme Court decisions from here on out are illegitimate rulings. So you've got some five, at least in the next 12 months, about 5 fairly controversial cases that may come down to a 5-4 ruling with Gorsuch as a tiebreaker, that I guess we'll see if these, like I said, the Democratic National Convention holds to its word and refuses to accept those rulings because they don't accept him as a justice, or if they'll eventually come around to that this was confirmation was done in a perfectly legal way.
But, I'm sure that the former of those two options is the likelier. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. And we've got a whole lot of content up there, including just about everything that we talked about on the program today. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round. Just a one last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this past week. That's coming up next. We'll be right back.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take a look at some headlines that we haven't covered yet. We'll start with Jeremiah.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte had been planning to visit Pag-asa Island on Independence Day. Pag-asa is the largest island in the Philippine-occupied areas in the Spratly chain, which China also claims, and Mr. Duterte was planning to just travel there and raise a Philippine flag as a show of the Philippines' rightful ownership. But then the leadership in China called Mr. Duterte up and asked him not to do it. And on Thursday of this week, Mr. Duterte said because of China's request, he will not go there after all.
Mm-hmm. And to Brent.
A young British woman was stabbed to death with a kitchen knife while riding on Jerusalem's light rail today. An off-duty police officer and a passerby wrestled the terrorist, a Palestinian man, from East Jerusalem to the ground before he could harm anybody else. The woman was currently in Israel on a tourist visa, and these terrorists don't usually attack tourists since it's bad for public relations for them. In this case, he did, and this was done on the light rail, where if you talk to anyone in Jerusalem, they've been on the light rail.
All right, we'll go now to Richard.
German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble told Muslim migrants, if you don't like Europe, go back home. He said there are better places in the world to live under Islamic law than Europe. He told them that they're welcome in Germany, but they have to accept our way of life.
Back to Jeremiah.
China's military is developing powerful lasers, electromagnetic railguns, and microwave weapons for use in attacks on satellites. Experts say China's building these weapons with one aim, to neutralize America's key strategic advantage, which is the web of satellites enabling military strikes of unparalleled precision far from U.S. shores. So American satellites are increasingly vulnerable, and they are in China's sights.
Over to Andrew.
United States President Donald Trump signed a new law this morning, a law overturning a last-minute Obama-era regulation forcing states to fund Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood is America's largest abortion provider, and although the Obama-era regulation didn't force states to fund abortions directly, it did force them to give money to Planned Parenthood for other causes. The new law Mr. Trump signed this morning now leaves it up to the individual states to decide for themselves whether they want to give them that money or not.
All right, over to Brent.
Turkish voters go to the polls this Sunday, April 16th, to decide whether to hand over more powers to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The proposed constitutional changes would transform Turkey's government from a parliamentary system to an executive presidency by eliminating the position of prime minister and allowing the president to rule by decree, appoint high officials and judges, and dissolve parliament at will. If passed, the referendum would allow Erdogan to stay in power until 2029 through presidential elections that would be held in 2019 and 2024.
Okay, over to Jeremiah.
Russia has almost completed its new air and missile defense system, the S-500. And some military experts say this system is so advanced that it will render even America's most sophisticated warplanes obsolete. The S-500 is expected to be highly mobile and will use a network of radars for targeting over vast distances. And U.S. defense officials believe that America's F-22, the B-2, and even the brand new F-35 would have serious problems overcoming them.
All right, we'll finish with Andrew.
Tomorrow is the deadline for United States citizens to get their taxes filed. According to a new report released this week, the federal government has collected over $1.4 trillion in taxes during the first half of fiscal year 2017, which began in October. This means that since 1998, tax revenues have increased almost 30%. Yet, shockingly, the government was still able to run a $500 billion deficit during that same time period from October.
Ouch. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com and read the stories that we talked about on the program today. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Sidney Harris. The whole purpose of education is to turn mirrors into windows. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.